to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962 when Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. The black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama, to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me, now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully, and we've had the plane protected and guarded all night." And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Dr. Martin Luther King speaking April 3, 1968. Within 24 hours, he would be dead, assassinated on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, April 4, 1968. Today is the federal holiday that honors him. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriano Contreras, and Maria Terracena. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Vesta Godarz, and Carl Marxer. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Krug-Meadows, Anna Osbeck, and Matt Ely. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our
WRCT in sound from way out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the various right-wing organizations, efforts at the state level, and big money to whittle away at what is left of American democracy.
We have with us as our guest, David Armiak, who is the research director for the Center for Media Democracy
we'll
in Madison, Wisconsin.
Distinguished
constitutional litigator Martin Garbus on the direction in which the Supreme Court is going.
As Martin Garbus will explain, the Supreme Court is not headed in a direction that would support democracy. In fact, it is going in the other direction. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
We are at a pivotal moment in this country, and the coming year may well decide whether we can right the course of history. Professor Nancy MacLean's important book, Democracy in Chains, revealed the right's decades-long stealth campaign to reverse-engineer America back to the days when the robber barons reigned supreme and rigged the legal and constitutional rules to work in their favor. She wrote that Trump and the forces of the right are actively trying to rig the conducting and counting of elections, state by state, as they create a frightening, autocratic, post-truth society few would have ever thought possible in America. The January 6th insurrection was a dress rehearsal for a Trump coup attempt in 2024. If he loses the election, Trump and his far-right supporters are laying the groundwork in state legislatures to take control of the electoral process to reverse the loss and claim a victory. The alliances between the corporate state, Trump, and white nationalists have seen a flood of dark money to subvert free and fair elections, block climate and economic justice legislation, push for a constitutional convention to permanently guarantee the rule of the rich, and the crippling of the federal government's ability to protect working families, the environment, and promote equity for all. The investigative journalism published by the Center for Media and Democracy has exposed groups on the far right, like the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, or the Heritage Action, or the Republican Attorneys General Association, RAGA, which are working hard to suppress the vote, tear down the firewall to protect our democracy in 2022, and put Trump acolytes in positions of power where they can subvert future elections. We speak today with David Armiak, who's a research director with the Center for Media Democracy. He has conducted extensive investigations on dark money, corporate corruption, and right-wing networks, and is responsible for filing and analyzing hundreds of public records requests every year. David Armiak, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
David, please talk about the special interests that have deformed American politics and poisoned the American polity.
Oh, geez, where to start? We could talk about big polluters or big tobacco, big pharma, defense contractors. You know, it's hard to answer in a short, amount of time, but, you know, it's really corporate America and how they built up this, you know, massive lobbying infrastructure and, you know, dark money and campaign vehicles in order to, you know, sway both politicians and the American public to deregulate our economy and protect, you know, their corporate profits, which are quite dear to them.
It's pretty clear to all that the right wing, for decades now, has been using a stealth campaign, if you will, to reverse, really, engineer America back to the days when the robber barons reigned without any interference to speak of. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that and what the impact of that has been on where we're at now in America.
Yeah, sure. So, there's a number of different facets. One place to start is the disastrous Citizens United ruling, mm-hmm. which unleashed a flood of campaign financing and unlimited amounts of money, to our political system. What that has done is it has allowed those with more money, the extremely wealthy individuals, Charles Koch, for example. The CEO of Koch Industries, and other billionaires and millionaires to have greater access and greater sway, over our politicians, to deregulate our economy, to, create tax codes, which, benefit them and increase their profits, to build, a steady base of politicians that are receptive when they are in need of something, whether it be at the state level, the city level, county level, or national level.
David Armiak from the Center for Media Democracy. Tell our audience what dark money is, please.
Yes, sure. So dark money is money that is untraceable to, the individual. To give you an example, right, campaigns will accept donations and in their filings list those individual donations there, right? But now we have things like super PACs, for example, where folks can use it as a sort of pass-through, so to say, where they can give the money to that PAC or that political action committee, and then that political action committee will give money to a candidate or candidates. A good example of this, I was speaking of Charles Koch earlier, is Charles Koch's Americans for Prosperity Action. So billionaires or millionaires or other donors will give money there, and then that, PAC will distribute the money. So we don't know exactly, where that money is coming from for a particular candidate. We know that it's coming through a committee, but we don't know, who that individual, actually gave that money. There's other examples in the nonprofit sector. So there's a large number of groups that are seeking to influence our judiciary system, and there are nonprofits set up. And in this case, we don't even know, because they're not required to disclose on federal filings, who is giving money to these nonprofits. But these nonprofits then in turn do issue campaigns, place ads to try to get their judges seated, whether it be at the Supreme Court level or other levels of government.
David, you mentioned Charles Koch and the Koch brothers we've heard about. With respect to Charles Koch, though, just how rich is he, and what are some of the more pernicious, from our point of view, in terms of what you're talking about, what's our threat to democracy and such, does he have, and what has he been up to over the last several decades, and what has been the impact of that, do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question. So Charles Koch is the owner and CEO of Koch Industries. He's worth $54 billion. In the past, people referred to their operation or their political operation as the Koch brothers' operation, because it was him and his brother David who were running it. But David passed away some years ago. They're libertarian in terms of philosophy, so small government is something that they're, very interested in, no or little, as little regulations as possible. In terms of connections, he has lots of them. And as of late, he has sought to rebrand himself as someone who is, not of a certain party, or someone who, seeks to raise the wealth of wealthy, leaving the others behind, but as someone who cares, deeply about, all Americans. But In fact, that has really, not been the case. Organizations that he, has funded and politicians that he have funded have really done a lot of damage to our country. You take the insurrection, for example. Many of those who voted to not certify the election results received significant amounts of money of Koch cash over the years, of Koch network backing, from organizations like his AstroTurf Army, Americans for Prosperity, or they were members of the American Legislative Exchange Council, a state-based national organization that brings together state lawmakers together with corporate lobbyists to write model legislation or push policies into the state that are of great interest to corporations. He's also been, very involved in the remaking of our federal and state and local judiciary to get, corporate-friendly judges placed and rewrite how cases are held or cases are decided. So really, he's been incredibly influential over the years. And I haven't even gotten into, the work that he's done, to try to sway university campuses across the country and move them to the right. He sees a lot of them as, socialist or communist centers of thought and has, worked, quite in a sophisticated way to fund libertarian centers or centers that push things like deregulation, from funding of students to actual funding of professorships to providing resources to house all of them in campuses across the country and other places of the world as well.
David, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, has done stuff regarding voter suppression and gerrymandering, and I wonder whether you could talk about that, please.
Yes. So, I'm glad you asked that question. The Center for Media and Democracy has, been keeping very close tabs on ALEC for over 10 years now, based on a large number of whistleblower documents, including hundreds of model bills that we received just over 10 years ago. And we house them on our blog, alecexposed.org. But they started around 10 years ago, pushing model legislation around voting in elections, most prominently the voter ID law, which is a form of voter suppression. There's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says you need an ID to vote, but they successfully placed this in many state locales, which has been an obstacle for folks to vote. But more recently, just last year, that they were working with the Dark Money Project called the Honest Elections Project, which is associated with Trump's Drudge Whisperer, Leonard Leo, man responsible for moving our judiciary to the right during the Trump administration. But to circulate different types of voter suppression bills and push for policies that'll make it harder for people to vote in future years. And they've met for 2.5 days before their summer meeting 2021. And then just in December, we found out that in their so-called States and Nation Policy Summit, that they held another two-day meeting to, with national leaders on the right, many of which, I should say, are affiliated with Trump and his network that's developed since he's left office.
I'm curious about the Republican Attorney General Association. I assume, as the name suggests, it consists of some or all of the, attorney generals of the Republican Party across the country. RAGA is its four-letter short name. More importantly, what have they been doing and what do we suspect they were doing or know that they've been doing with regard to the January 6th insurrection?
Yeah, so this is another organization that the Center for Media and Democracy has been tracking very closely. And yes, you're right to assume, that RAGA or the Republican Attorney General Association is made up of Republican Attorney Generals, although some have sought to distance themselves since it became clear that they were involved with the January 6th insurrection. Evidence of that includes that, Attorney General from the state of Texas, Ken Paxton, spoke at the rally preceding the march, which resulted in the insurrection. The 501c4 nonprofit affiliated with RAGA, called the Rule of Law Defense Fund, sent out a robocall calling on people to march on the Capitol on January 6th. But they also, we know, in looking through open records requests, that they held meetings to strategize about what to do, following the election. And many of them were involved in, different challenges, following the election of Biden between, that election and January 6th. But in general, RAGA is a pay-to-pay group. They, bring in corporations. Right. And depending on what level you pay at, you get different types of access to attorney generals at their meetings, which they hold at least four times a year, although it now appears that they hold many more than that. And they work on all different types of policy. They work together to coordinate amicus briefs, it appears, which are, sort of supporting documents for court cases. So it's a very powerful organization. And, you know, after Trump lost his election and Biden was elected, they called themselves, you know, the first, you know, sort of front to protect, you know, Republican or, you know, right wing interests, you know, after the Democrats in January won those Senate races down south and secured, you know, complete control of Congress and the White House.
David, I'd like to speak further with you about the flow of dark money and what it's doing to subvert free and fair elections. What do they do to rig the legal and constitutional rules in their favor? And please specifically discuss the obstacles they've set up to voting and to and the gerrymandering that's been accomplished.
In speaking about dark money, so one of the main groups that we've been able to identify, work on, as I mentioned before, is the Honest Elections Project. So this is actually not even a registered organization. It's a legal alias of the 85 Fund, which is a nonprofit associated with Leonard Leo's network. And, you know, things that they are doing, you know, are try to make it harder for people to vote absentee, to try to get rid of the voter ballot boxes that some of the cities and states, you know, set up during the pandemic, which allowed people to drop off their ballots safely, right, without having to interact with folks. But they're advocating for you know, purging of voter rolls, for example, expanded voter ID, so narrowing the definition of indefinite or confinement or, you know, disability, you know, which some people, you know, it's very hard to figure to navigate through the system. So it results in, you know, people giving up or not really being able to vote because they're not aware until it's too late, right? So, yeah, I mean, this is the type of stuff that you know, the right with dark money are working on to make it more difficult for folks to vote. Mm-hmm.
David, we've heard more in recent years about the Federalist Society. What is the Federalist Society, and its head is Leonard Leo? Why do they call him the quote-unquote judge whisperer? What connections, in essence, does all of this have with far-right groups and with what they're trying to do to influence courts, judgeships, and the like?
Yeah, another great question. You know, it's an organization that's incredibly powerful, the Federalist Society, and one that not many people are aware of. They have chapters in just about every state or every state. It's been a while since I double-checked that. They meet, you know, in different locales. They have connections with university faculty and law schools. They have centers within law schools for conservative or right-wing law students so that they can, you know, sort of get a pipeline into particular jobs. So they do a lot of, you know, sort of networking and also so-called education, right, to push different types of legal theories. A lot of it, you know, is based on, you know, so-called originalism thought. So in its head, right, as you mentioned, Leonard Leo, and they call him the Judge Whisperer because he was tasked when Trump was elected back in 2016 to develop a list of potential Supreme Court justices in case he needed to fill any openings, which, of course, he did. He had to fill three over the course of his, you know, 4 years in office. But he also advised him, you know, on filling, you know, hundreds of federal positions across the country in the federal judiciary, which has resulted in the packing or capturing of courts. You know, if you're able to get the courts, right, the judges, then you'll be able, you know, their thinking is that they'll be able to get the decisions that they want, you know, when they bring those courts up. The scary thing is in many cases, you know, they chose very, very young judges, and they place these judges in lifetime, you know, appointments. You know, the effects of this, you know, are really going to be long term. And it's hard to determine, you know, exactly what that means, you know, for our future. But certainly it's going to be good things for corporations as they bring, you know, cases to the courts to have corporate friendly judges there. In terms of connections, you mentioned what kind of connections does he have, you know, does Federalist Society have with other far right groups? Many. I mean, I'd already spoken about Honest Elections Project. He's gotten into voting. He has some judicial activism groups. You know, Judicial Crisis Network is one of them that works to help get judges seated and to present a positive, you know, light of judges. and many of these, I should say, are, you know, Federalist Society members. So it's all, you know, very, very much so interconnected.
David, how do all these forces plan to lock in power permanently?
Well, there's a couple ways. So, you know, I didn't answer your gerrymandering question, but that's one. So, you know, if they are able to successfully gerrymander or redistrict so that they, you know, on the right are able to maintain control of state houses and bring more, you know, Republicans to, you know, the U.S. House and the U.S. in particular, then, you know, they will have, you know, more influence. And, you know, a place like Wisconsin, where I am, you know, that's become very clear. You know, they challenged the maps that were drawn by the legislature here. And, you know, the judges, you know, the governor refused to sign them. So it went to the state Supreme Court, which has been packed with, you know, right-wing judges. Those judges have said, you know, we're basically going to do minimal changes from the map 10 years ago. So they're going to get another 10 years of, you know, a gerrymander, you know, which is really unfortunate for people in the state. But the other way that they plan to lock in power permanently is through a constitutional convention or what is known as the Article V process. So they're hoping to force a state-led constitutional convention to radically rewrite our constitution, which would, you know, they could do all types of things once they're there, because there really aren't a lot of rules or parameters for this type of convention. It's never been held since the first one was held. To write our original constitution. So they could, you know, do away with all types of regulations. They could do away with federal agencies or departments, like, you know, getting rid of the Department of Education. They could, you know, allow states to ignore Supreme Court rulings. They could put in restrictions around voting. They could do whatever once they get there. If we look at the makeup of state legislatures across the country, you know, the vast majority of them are, you know, Republican-led and dominated. So you can only imagine, you know, the types of things that they might want to do if they're able to, you know, start from scratch and rewrite our nation's founding document.
Well, David Armiak, I guess the ultimate question that, or at least for the moment, is what does all this portend for the outcome of the 2024 presidential election? I mean, we have any number of respected historians and political analysts wondering if this isn't going to mark the end of what little is left of American democracy. What is your thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, we're totally worried about, you know, the outcome and what might happen, you know, in 2024, especially after watching what unfolded, you know, the last time around. You know, there's a lot of disinformation around that is, you know, floating around. The networks to push out that disinformation are, you know, expanding and are more well-funded and more sophisticated. It's very scary to think about what possibly, you know, might happen. But with the voter suppression bills that are passing in state houses across the country, it's really going to benefit Republicans, or it seems like it will benefit Republicans in the long run. And as long as we have the Electoral College system, you know, they can, you know, likely find a way, you know, on the right to push their candidate forward, whether that's Trump or the governor down in Florida, DeSantis, whoever, you know, on the right that they really want. Yeah, I don't know if it will mark the end of American democracy. I really try to think more optimistically, but I'm definitely worried and concerned, and a lot of people are, and that's why we continue, you know, to fight to expose their efforts and to provide, you know, information on, you know, what the right is up to, you know, around voter suppression and elections and voting, you know, so that it can be, you know, exposed, and hopefully policymakers that are in a position of power right now, you know, will do the right thing and, you know, pass laws to prevent this from happening in the states.
We've been talking with David Armiak from the Center for Media Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin. David, before we have to say goodbye, can you tell our listeners how they can follow your work?
Yes, sure. Happy to. So we publish on our blog, exposedbycmd.org, but you can also follow us on Twitter at exposedbycmd. We also maintain a couple wikis that feature a lot of our research. I spoke at length about the American Legislative Exchange Council, so you can go to alecexposed.org to find everything and anything about ALEC, including your state politicians that are members, most recent model bills that have been introduced and passed by the organization, and you know, corporations and other organizations that are members.
Before our show today, we learned that in the Congress now, coming from Mitch McConnell, coming from other Republicans, coming from Manchin, there's talk of tweaking a bit the 1887 Electoral Count Act that you made some reference to, the electoral vote. And many on the other side of the aisle, the Democratic part of the aisle, of course, see that as a trap, and that's a road we shouldn't go down. I wonder what your thought is on that or any other last point you'd like to make.
My sense of all that is with Manchin and McConnell and the Republicans, you know, opposing taking up any kind of voting stuff, or is just a delay. They're just hoping to keep delaying, and that once the 2022 midterms come, they're hoping to retake the House, possibly the Senate. They'll be able to prevent it. So that's why I think they just keep flipping back and forth and suggesting different things. It's just a matter of, you know, just trying to keep delaying. To prevent any type of action at the federal level. I will also say that if it's related to the Electoral College, I am kind of concerned, because there is another effort, right, that you may be aware of called the National Popular Vote Compact. And quite a few states have already passed. And what they're trying to do is that if, you know, all the states in the compact, you know, reach a certain number of Electoral College votes, that they'll all agree to vote for the candidate or push their Electoral College delegates to the candidate that wins the popular vote in all those states that are part of the compact. So this is kind of a way to get around the issue of candidates losing the popular vote but winning, right? You know, as what we saw, you know, for example, in 2016 with Trump, he won the election but lost the popular vote by 3 million. So perhaps they're trying to work on this. We know for a fact that the right wing is taking this very seriously. They have a campaign called Save Our States that is, you know, specifically, you know, dedicated to work on this issue and is well funded to try to preserve the Electoral College and defeat this effort to determine, you know, presidential election by popular vote.
Thank you for that, David. Really.
Yeah, thank you, David. You know, we've come to an end, unfortunately, to our allotted time. So Jim and I are going to have to say goodbye, but we're very grateful for your being on Law and Disorder, and we wish you and the Center for Media Democracy all the best in the coming year.
Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah, Happy New Year to you both, and wish you a good year.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Supreme Court, as presently constituted, has six reactionary judges and three liberal-minded ones. progressive people are alarmed by its recent decisions and fearful of what it might do in the future. One of the liberals on the court, Stephen Breyer, is 83 years old. Should he retire, it would give the Democrats the opportunity to try to appoint a replacement who's not a reactionary. This will be an uphill battle, but it's a fight well worth it. A right-winger will certainly get the job if a Republican president and a Republican-controlled Senate in the year 2024 choose a successor to Breyer if he dies or retires. When Barack Obama was president, he hinted to the liberal Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was 80 years old and a two-time cancer patient, to step down, but she declined. Ginsburg died while still serving as a justice of the Supreme Court. Republicans in the Senate would not allow a vote for Judge Merrick Garland, whom Obama had nominated for the Supreme Court seat. Ginsburg was then replaced by the young right-wing Brett Kavanaugh, who joined two other young right-wing Trump judges. The Trump-dominated Republican Party is well aware that to topple democracy, they must take over the courts. The current Roberts Court has, for more than a decade, consistently leveled this attack on democracy by eviscerating the Voting Rights Act, unleashing unlimited corporate monies into elections, allowing clearly partisan gerrymandering of elections, and is now training its sights against reproductive choice by severely restricting abortion rights. Yale historian Jason Stanley has recently written, "There is every reason to believe that the court will allow even the simplest of democracy to crumble as long as laws are passed by gerrymandered Republican state houses that make anti-democratic practices, including stealing elections, legal." We speak today with returning guest attorney Martin Garbus. He's a constitutional litigator who has represented Stephen Donziger, Nelson Mandela, Daniel Ellsberg, and Lenny Bruce.
Welcome to Law and Disorder, Martin.
Thank you. It's a great, great pleasure to be talking to you.
What did you think of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's decision not to retire when Obama could have replaced her on the Supreme Court?
I think it was awful when Thurgood Marshall refused to step down. Thurgood Marshall, of course, leads to Clarence Thomas. Ruth Ginsburg, of course, leads to Amy Coney Barrett. And now with Breyer, we're going through the same thing again, except now there is an ostensible majority, a Democratic majority, in the Senate. And although the Republicans' new game plan to delay, delay, delay will cause a war, and there can be a fight and we can lose it, I think it's the time to make that fight now. If you have a Republican in 2024, you will have a United States Supreme Court at 7-2 for decades.
Marty, what was the role that Ruth Bader Ginsburg played on the Supreme Court, and why was it important?
I think she was very important. I think she stood as a role model for men and women. I think that she bought her politics, which is close to ours or mine, and I think she was relentless. I think, on the other hand, she also was a woman, as we all have our vanities, who did not step down, even after bouts of cancer. She didn't approach it all as clean, let's say, as Breyer is. She hung on far, far too long. And if you look at the important Supreme Court cases of the last years, Citizens United, Shelby, and then the sequela to Goldberg against Kelly, you see the reinforcement of the end of a democracy. And we're now in a political time when we recognize the stakes are very, very different when it was Ruth Ginsburg and Thurgood Marshall time to step down. You now have the possibility of what people call a democracy. We know, of course, it never has been that, but of actually causing this government structure to end. So we're at a critical time. Breyer has served 27 years. Ruth Ginsburg served 28. Kennedy, who stepped down when he was asked to do so by Trump, so he could then appoint a Kavanaugh type, has acted totally differently than the Democrats. And I think what has happened over the years is the Democrats have just failed at this whole question of fighting over the court. And one of the reasons, I think, is because people like Breyer insist that judges on the United States Supreme Court are not voting out of political ideology. But as he puts it, he says when you see differences on the court, it's a different interpretation of the law. I don't think anybody believes that. Michael, Marge, we've all spent time in the political area. We've all spent time in the courts. We all know very dear friends. I was trying voting rights cases in the early 60s in the South. And to think that politics did not determine the cases is delusional.
Martin, why was Ruth Bader Ginsburg's role on the Supreme Court so significant?
Well, she was an important voice for a liberal set of views. She did not delude herself and think that court decisions were made by the law itself. She understood that decisions were made for political reasons. So, first of all, she saw the law differently than someone like Breyer. She had fought the great fight, as it was seen that she had fought the great fight and a great commitment to women's rights. Of course, her commitment went far wider than that. But she got cancer. She had two cancer surgeries, and she refused to step down. Had the Democrats, either both Obama and Biden, had a chance to appoint younger judges, younger Democrats, who wouldn't be sitting on the court now, and might outlive some of the conservatives, you would have a totally different world. You look at three cases in the United States, you can see what's going on, or even two, the voting rights case, Shelby against Holder, and then you can look at Citizens United. And those two cases have basically decimated our democracy. And whatever reason she had then for not stepping down, there was a certain political atmosphere then, but the political atmosphere today is far, far different. We all recognize that we're now at a point where this very government form may not function. People now, I admit, this country of freedom for each person, et cetera, never existed. We all know about, of course, slavery and how the country existed in 1800. We also know now that the government structure of how you appoint electors and how you vote in elections has been totally destroyed by the Republicans, so that they can easily, in power, take away more and more rights. So at the time of Ginsburg and then Thurgood Marshall before her, who refused to step down, we did not have a situation where this country was so much at stake. And just a few more decisions, like Shelby, like Citizens United, like the sequela to Goldberg against Kelly, and this undemocratic country becomes more undemocratic and flows towards some other kind of political institution.
Marty, could you explain to our listeners what Shelby versus Holder was all about and why it was so significant, and do the same with the Citizens United decision as well, please?
In the 2020 election, you saw a dramatic change in voting habits. You saw 43% of American voters voting by mail. You saw 26% of the Americans voting early, a dramatic change in the voting process, and that supported, basically, that allowed minority groups to come to the polls, and it dramatically changed the amounts of Democrats, so that in the last couple of years, you have seen the Democrats win with respect to the sheer numbers in the election, and then you see them lose because of the setup of the Electoral College. So what you're dealing with is the infirmity, in a way, of the Constitution, which, although it says each man is equal, et cetera, you don't have equal rights. We know that, of course, throughout the United States, throughout the 1800s, 1900s, you never had equality at the polls. And then in 1965, there was passed the Voting Rights Act, which attempted to protect minority groups so that they could vote. And then the Republicans saw that if you close down certain things, voting, if you close down voting polls near black communities, and if you close down the opportunity of people to get to the polls, you could dramatically change the election results. So what happens is, having changed the election results, you then get Republican minorities changing the structure of the government. And that's going to continue between the infirmities in the Constitution and the striking down of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. There has been a total attack on the voting system. Citizens United dealt with the ability of wealthy people to pour endless money into campaigns. So both of those cases deal with the takeover of the voting system. The third case, the case that I was involved in, and it's called Goldberg against Kelly. That case is decided in 1970, before Brennan steps down, before Berger comes in. It's the end of the Warren Court. And in that case, I represented the plaintiffs. We were trying to create a groundwork for something like a minimum income. It dealt with equality. Brennan said, 5-4 decision, Brennan wrote it, said it was the most important due process case of the century, because he understood how you could take that case, and on that, you could build and build and build and deal with the economic disparities in the United States. Well, but a year after Goldberg is decided, as I said, Brennan is down, the Warren Court's over, and since then, all you've seen with the Republican court is a total attack on that decision and any case that attempts to deal with income inequality. Brennan was very optimistic that Goldberg, which he basically put together, the discussion that goes on in the United States Supreme Court when Brennan is trying to persuade a majority to go with him, is historic and marvelous, and it took an enormous amount of work, and it was a great, great victory. And then, since 1970, the United States Supreme Court, under Republican leadership, has cut away and eviscerated that case. Adam Cohn, a very fine New York Times reporter, wrote a book called Supreme Inequality, dealing with that case. I wrote a book called Courting Disaster, Dealing with Voting Money and Goldberg against Kelly. And I think that we were all unfortunately prescient in seeing exactly what would happen, but none of us ever visualized that we would be where we are today. And January 6th, I don't know how you all felt about January 6th. There was a part of me that was glad to see it, because I understood that was there, and that unless it was exposed and unless it was ripped open, it would just continue quietly as the powers that led to Trump and supported his ideology would be built up. So I think that January 6th is very much a result of the frustration, and that frustration tells us that if in the years to come, Trump or people who feel like him are elected, whether it be Abbott or DeSantis, that you will see the Constitution basically discarded. This is a critical time. It's unlike when Thurgood Marshall did not step down. It's unlike when Ginsburg did not step down. You could say that she was right in not stepping down, but that would still not make Breyer right in not stepping down now. And what's amazing is that the Democrats, basically, since 1980, have not dealt with the question of the legal system in the same way that the Republicans have. The Republicans formed the Federalist Society in 1980. Others would write about what was happening, try to encourage a Democratic response. We all failed. The Republicans had the battlefield, except for Nan Arryn in Washington, who was focused on the courts. Very, very few Democrats were, which is astonishing. And the fact that Breyer doesn't step down now is a continuation of that failure. So it's really been, you can see, 40 years or more of Democratic failure when someone like Breyer says that judges do not make political decisions, when Breyer says the decisions are world-based legal differences, it's delusional. There was a wonderful constitutional philosopher, Ronald Dworkin, and he used to say the same thing. And then he and I talked at the time of Bush against Gore, and he totally changed his position. How someone like Breyer today, after Citizens United, Bush against Gore, the Voting Rights Act case, can continue to say the same thing is just, it's preposterous. Very few people on the Supreme Court will say what he says with a sense that it's really true. They may say it politically, but certainly Ginsburg did not say that. Ruth Ginsburg had every obligation to step down, certainly over cancer. Thurgood Marshall could not function on the court physically. And the question is why, and Breyer should get out. The question as to why these people do not step down, is it vanity? They have a commitment and this is what they have done? Those are hard things to answer. Clearly, Ruth Ginsburg enjoyed being the notorious RBG. But the precedent she sets for other Democrats who say, well, she didn't step down, I won't step down, is wrong, and it's killing the country.
Marty Garbus, in 2019, the Supreme Court refused to put guardrails on partisan gerrymandering. Then, before the 2020 elections, during the pandemic, the court refused to extend Wisconsin's deadline for submitting absentee ballots. And last summer, the reactionary justices greenlit voter suppression in the Brnovich decision. Justice Sotomayor said she doesn't, quote, see how it's possible that the court will be viewed as a nonpartisan and fair after the reactionary justices rolled back abortion rights. Therefore, do you think new seats should be added to the Supreme Court? Do you think the justices should be term limited? And if so, how to do it?
I don't think it can be done. It's a very good question because people are talking about it. New seats, limits, I don't think you can get anywhere with it. It's an issue that many Democrats would oppose, and certainly the Republicans would oppose it. So yes, it's being talked about, but I don't think the conversation has any meaning.
And are you talking there, Marty, about adding new seats to the Supreme Court or term limits?
I think both. I think there's no chance of either.
Whether there's a chance or not, do you think it should be attempted?
I think it is such an obvious loser that I don't. I think what should be attempted is Democrats becoming as political and as responsible as someone like Arthur Kennedy, who steps down so that a Kavanaugh type can be appointed. I think what should happen is the Ruth Ginsburg, the Thurgood Marshalls, the Democratic nominee should realize what the court is about. Jeffrey Rosen, a very respected scholar, talked about the Supreme Court or the court system as being the only place that is nonpartisan. Years ago, he wrote a book about how it's the only place where democracy really exists. And it's clear now that that's nonsense. I thought it was nonsense at the time, but there's no way of believing that's not nonsense now.
Marty, how does the number of federal judges that Biden has nominated compare to the number that Trump nominated and the number that Obama nominated?
Well, there have been a great deal of nominations. I don't know the details of the circuit court and the district court nominations, but in the circuit courts, they are so dominated, by and large, with very few exceptions, by the Republicans. I mean, the Ninth Circuit, when all of us grew up, was a great liberal court, and the government has done everything they can to weaken that court by even when cases from the Ninth Circuit come up to the United States Supreme Court, the Supreme Court treats the Ninth Circuit as a Democratic court and has very little reluctance to reject their cases, while at the same time, cases that come up from the Fifth Circuit, which is a Republican court, are nearly uniformly followed in the United States Supreme Court. So I think that there has to be a grassroots awareness of all this. The Republicans have had it certainly since 1980. The Democrats never had it and don't have it. How could Ruth Ginsburg justify it? After two cancer operations, before she finally gets off, her staying on the court. Trump would have had her off in a minute, but Trump is the yardstick for the opposition at this moment. So to say that you're going to be nobler than thou, as Breyer says, and says it's not politics that decide cases, is just naive. I don't know how you can have an intelligent discussion or a real battle for the Supreme Court when the Republicans get away with asking people to step down. Years ago, Arthur Goldberg stepped down. That was a kind of a different situation. But he talked about vanity as a factor. And I think that has to be there. One thing about Arthur Kennedy, people recognized that he came from a certain elite economic strata, and his concerns were to make his strata far better. Breyer and Ginsburg also come from a very, very different economic strata than Sotomayor. They have had a life of privilege. Sotomayor's voice is speaking up for those who did not have a life of privilege and want to see, get some of the benefits of the money that's there.
Marty Garbus, unfortunately, we've run out of our allotted time. It's been wonderful having you on Law and Disorder. Thank you very much for your insights, and we hope you'll come back on the show. You have a good new year.
Thank you.
Take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
Sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Gramsci, the slogan that he made famous was pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. We have to look at the world reasonably, without illusions. That's pessimism of the intellect. At the same time, we recognize there are ways out. So we have optimism of the will, meaning we dedicate ourselves to using all the opportunities that are available and move towards a more just, decent world.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on optimism of the will. How to be positive in these perilous times? Humankind and the planet are facing enormous dangers. We can indulge in magical thinking and hope for miracles, or we can ground ourselves in reality, understand the depth of the crises we face, and then act to change things. It won't be easy. There are huge obstacles and difficulties. Our task going forward is to find kindred spirits, organize, and work to create a decent future. We may be inspired by the adage, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. It was made famous by the great 20th century Italian Marxist thinker and writer Antonio Gramsci. A dedicated anti-fascist, Gramsci languished for 11 years in Mussolini's jails, where his health deteriorated. He died in 1937. Today, there's a revival of interest in Gramsci and his work. In the Gramscian tradition of speaking truth to power is Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist. He's been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. Chris Hedges says he's America's greatest intellectual who makes the powerful, as well as their liberal apologists, deeply uncomfortable. Author of scores of books, Chomsky's latest are Consequences of Capitalism and Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal. I talked with him on December 9th, just 2 days after his 93rd birthday. He was at his home in Arizona. What we are facing is often described as unprecedented, a pandemic, climate catastrophe, and always lurking off center stage, nuclear annihilation. Three of the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Well, I can add a fourth, the impending destruction of what remains of American democracy and the shift of the United States towards a deeply authoritarian, possibly proto-fascist state when the Republicans come back into office, which looks likely. So that's four horses. And that has a big effect on the world and on the other three. Remember that the Republicans are the denialist party, the party that is committed to racing to climate destruction with abandon as quickly as possible into the hands of the chief wrecker, who they now worship like a demigod. It's bad news for the United States and for the world, given U.S. power.
The Swedish International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance annual report just came out on the global state of democracy. It says that the United States